From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. The science on climate change gets more and more alarming. The big environmental organizations like the Sierra Club and the NRDC are lawyered up and pushing for tougher regulations on the industries and fossil fuels that heat up the planet. But a new generation of climate activists is saying, not good enough. There's a new burst of protest on college campuses, at fracking wells, along pipelines, and in the nation's capital. This hour on Point, the edgier, more urgent new face of climate activism. We'll have three young climate activists with us today. With us first from Santa Barbara, California, is Emily Williams. She's a senior at UC Santa Barbara, majoring in environmental studies, 21 years old and committed. Emily Williams, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
It's great to have you right there. With me in the studio is Maura Cowley, 30, executive director of the Energy Action Coalition, brings together 50 youth groups advocating for clean energy and slowing climate change, originally from Scranton, Pennsylvania, deep in coal country. She spent 5 years at the Sierra Club, worked as a field organizer, campaign director, national director for the Sierra Student Coalition. Now she's moved on, has been arrested twice in front of the White House while protesting the Keystone XL pipeline. Maura Cowley, good to have you with us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
We'll have more voices in a moment, but let me begin with you two. Emily, you know, there's been environmentalism for a long, long time. There you are, 21, and doing it for your generation. Do you feel like you've got some special urgency, some special requirement to bring something new to it?
I mean, we certainly do. We've seen time and again that just the normal push for the environment from environmental activists before, it's not working anymore. The government isn't listening to us. The fossil fuel industries have a stranglehold on our political structure. So it's time to take another push. We see the levels of carbon dioxide raising so much. We're now at above 390 parts per million. And it's not acceptable. It's our generation that's going to be suffering the consequences and the future generations.
Let me welcome one more voice into our conversation. With me in the studio, Dorian Williams, an anthropology major and senior at Brandeis University, 21 years old, originally from Chicago, member of the Divest for Our Future campaign at Brandeis, of Students for a Just and Stable Future, and of 350 Massachusetts, part of the national group 350.org. She's been arrested 4 times already in protest actions. Dorian Williams, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
4 times? Arrested? In what period? Over how many years?
I guess since about 2011.
Where have you been arrested? Doing what?
D.C., West Virginia, and most recently here in Massachusetts.
When and in what were you arrested in D.C.?
Well, D.C. was twice. The first time was a part of PowerShift 2011. We were let off a side rally of the main rally that went to
This was in front of the Department of...
The Interior.
The Interior, okay.
Mm-hmm. So we were let off a side... And then sort of...
You're breathing a little hard from coming up
Sorry,
the stairs. No. That's totally fine. We're glad you're here. So what, you got pushed into the lobby of the Department of Interior?
Yeah, we stormed the lobby, filled it with people and instruments and...
Musical instruments?
Musical instruments.
Okay.
Drums, trombones. It was really quite the experience. And started out with maybe 50-plus people, and then there was 21 of us at the end of the police warnings, and they took us off. And the reason that we were at the Department of the Interior was because they oversee a lot of the siting and permitting for things like mountaintop removal, things like tar sands in Utah, mm-hmm. Some offshore drilling as well. So, you know, we really wanted to take it to them and show them this is unacceptable.
Twice in Washington, you were arrested in West Virginia, I believe, chained to a big truck or something at a coal mining site.
Correct. We were at the mine site in West Virginia. We were at Hobbit Mine, the largest in West Virginia. To protest mountaintop removal, you know, what they're doing to the people of West Virginia is, I mean, they're blowing up their homes, they're blowing up those mountains, they're polluting their water, they're destroying their livelihoods. If it was a country, not a corporation doing this, we would see a very different reaction from our government. But because of the way that corporations control our government, it's left to the people to defend them.
And you were arrested protesting the Keystone XL pipeline. Where, why, how?
First time in D.C. With tar sands action and the 1,253 of us over the course of a couple weeks, and most recently in Westboro, Massachusetts, where TransCanada has an office.
New Secretary of State John Kerry has just mm-hmm. said, I think they released the thing saying the State Department has no objection, in effect, has no environmental objection to the Keystone Pipeline, which would open the way for tar sands oil to come down from Canada. Did you expect that? You think are we going to see a Keystone Pipeline?
I hope not, you know, but we're running out of hope with President Obama's administration. You know, Kerry used to have a really great record on environmental issues, but, you know, with this recent report, I don't have a lot of faith or trust that they will do what's right. And what's right is rejecting the Keystone XL pipeline. But if they really choose to continue ignoring the climate effects, you know, I think it's majorly, you know, a betrayal of my generation. We were a huge part of how Obama got elected, and we will bear the brunt of climate change. And this will be on our shoulders now with the Keystone XL pipeline.
I want to talk about how all that's going to unfold. People talking about the Keystone XL pipeline decision and protest as perhaps the Selma of this generation's life when it comes to environmental protest. Maura, you're only 30, but you're our senior statesman here. You've been watching this for a long time. Do you, you know, we're going to have a lot of listeners way older than that, and they'll remember environmental protests and Earth Day and green this and green that going back for decades. And they may be wondering, what is new here? I mean, do you see something new in the quality, the perspective of protests, the nature of the protests that this generation, Dorian's and Emily's generation, is bringing to the table, bringing to the streets?
Yeah, I think the thing that I'm seeing that's really, really new is a social justice lens on all of this work. I think historically, the environmental movement has been very tied to conservation and protecting water and protecting air, and that's very important still. But what we're also seeing is people taking a stand, getting arrested, protesting to protect other people. Right now, fossil fuel industry pollutes low-income communities and communities of color at disproportionate rates. And for our generation, that is unacceptable. It's simply unacceptable. And so this new generation of activists that we're seeing across the country emerging, they are really intent on making sure that we stop climate change and that we push forward with clean energy that's equitably distributed across the country.
Emily Williams in California. We had Ralph Nader was in our backyard here a couple of months ago. And he said to students at Northeastern University, he was talking about your generation broadly, Emily. He said, you know, nothing changes if you don't have fire in your belly. And then he said this very tough thing on your generation. He said, you are a generation without even embers in your belly. You don't have fire in your belly. What do you say to that, Emily? Do you see evidence of fire in your generation's belly when it comes to the environment and climate?
Oh, I certainly do. I see a lot of fire in people's bellies. I think one of the problems that really has faced our generation so far is that climate change, even though it's the huge issue of our time, it's a little bit harder to put your finger on. It's not quite as tangible as, say, the social justice movements, the civil rights movements that happened before. But I think for a long time, our generation has known that something isn't right, and they've wanted to do something about it. And it's just now that there's a vessel, there's something that we can focus our attention on, something tangible that we can do.
Dorian, what's wrong with the traditional environmentalist movement, if there is something wrong with it?
What's wrong with the traditional?
Well, if this generation is out to do something new and do it somehow differently, that means you're changing trails somehow. We'll look at how you're changing trails, but what about the trail that this movement's been on?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that a lot of the people that I work with and a lot of members of my generation are prepared to really see this issue for what it is. I think a lot of the big environmental groups have been avoiding, in some ways, the true costs of climate change, the human costs of climate change, and how quickly and exponentially it is going to happen. The pace that they have been moving at is incredibly slow. They've been willing to play the inside game, and we've seen that the inside game does not work. And that's why, you know, as
Emily's inside game meaning lobbying for legislation, write the congressman, ask for higher, fuel mileage, and so on.
And preparing to settle for what is, in the end, not going to cut it, is not going to, you know, literally cut the carbon that we need in order to avoid 2 degrees Celsius.
If that inside game hasn't worked, what is the outside game? How do you bring an outside game to bear and change that big head of steam on energy as we know it?
Making it a public issue. I think that's what we've seen with Keystone. for the first time, we're really seeing people in the streets in the thousands, in the tens of thousands, people getting arrested in the thousands, people taking these steps and escalating to the point that we haven't seen yet with the climate movement and haven't seen in the environmental movement for an incredibly long time. And I think that we are prepared to meet with this sense of urgency the task ahead of us in a way that I think can only come from the people who know that their futures are at stake.
We're going to look at exactly what that means and what that path may look like already and in the months, years ahead. We're talking this hour about a harder, edgier, more urgent environmental movement with a new generation of climate activists. They see not just the planet, but their own lives and many others on the line. Bill McKibben talks a lot about it with 350.org. He's been on a campaign across the country looking to bring out students. They're coming out. Keystone Pipeline issue, bringing them out. Anais Mitchell behind us here performing Bob Dylan's A Hard Rain's Gonna Fall. This was a few months ago in Burlington, Vermont. That protest movement, that protest spirit in the streets. Again, you can join us this hour. Is it way too late for Earth Day? Is the urgency of climate change now calling for a different kind of protest, for taking it to the streets, to the boardrooms? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with a new generation of, don't call them environmentalists, call them climate activists. Environmentalism, admirable as it may have been, has not done the trick, not cut the mustard, they say. And a new younger generation is out to bring more urgency, more edge to environmental issues in front of us right now. Not just environmental issues, they say. These are social justice issues. These are, perhaps for their generation, survival issues. Just last month in Washington, big demonstration against the Keystone Pipeline. Here was college student David Pinsky explaining why he was there.
This pipeline is a symbol of the dying idea of capitalism and greed and wealth. That actually meant success, but what it actually means is death for not only our planet, but for us, for our species. And so I'm here to put a stop to it. And they talk about drawing a line in the sand. That's exactly what today is. We're 45,000 strong, and we're going to stop the Keystone. We're going to stop fracking.
The critique getting very big there. A couple months earlier, Florida A&M University Renewable Energy Conference. Some sound from that event. The effect is sort of climbing up the old environmental ladder. Since its creation 120 years ago, the Sierra Club had never acted in civil disobedience. That changed when they joined a protest, that same protest in February, against the Keystone XL pipeline in front of the White House. Here's Executive Director of the Sierra Club, Michael Bruhn, explaining the change in policy and his own arrest in front of the White House.
We can't win on climate change if we continue to dither, if we continue to talk about it but not do anything. And so the Sierra Club is engaging in civil disobedience for the first time because we have a moral catastrophe on our hands, and we need to do everything that we can to compel stronger, bolder action.
Big divestment movement across the country, students asking the leaders at their universities to pull college funds out of the stock shares of big energy companies, fossil fuel energy companies. Here's an Al Jazeera interview, Shihab Ratansi. Ratansi asking a Harvard student, Ali Welton, about the goal of the divestment movement running through college campuses now.
We want to stigmatize them in the same way that tobacco corporations were stigmatized by the divestment movement a few decades ago, to the point where politicians are unwilling to accept donations from tobacco corporations, or hopefully in the future fossil fuel corporations, because there's such a huge negative societal stigma attached to them.
Don't just pull the money out for the financial hit, but stigmatize those companies so they can't keep doing what they're doing. Bring on the social pressure. Emily Williams is here, Maura Cowley, Dorian Williams, and lots of callers. Joe's calling from Manchester, Connecticut. Hi, Joe, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom, how are you doing today?
Okay, what do you see?
Well, I'm going to date myself. I remember back when I was just a wee child going to one of the very first named Earth Days. And we had regular school trips a few times back in the 70s. And then and I remember seeing, you know, this was, of course, the height of NASA and everything else, with end of the space program. I remember Skylab and all of that. and then all that positive energy as we moved into the 80s and on into the 90s just went. I remember, I was dabbling in architecture, reading books, and yeah, this is how you build energy-efficient houses. This is back in the 70s, and for a long time, that just went away. And then recently when I was in college, SUNY at New Paltz, we actually had on campus, it was the remnants of an efficient community, experimental housing.
Joe, let me ask, does it make sense to you, Joe, that this new generation would look out at the years in front of them and the kind of climate signals that we're getting and say, we can't just go on that schedule anymore. We've got to spur this thing faster, bigger.
Well, part of what I was getting at is that this current generation wouldn't be needing to do this if that momentum hadn't been quashed during the good times of the 80s and, early 90s, which, now in retrospect were maybe not as good. We had the Generation X, the me generation, and whatnot.
Yeah, and off it went. Off went that energy, and here we are with our climate situation. I appreciate your call, Joe. Maura, do you have a sense that despite all the ongoing talk about green this and recycling and everything else, we came to a place of complacency when it comes to the scale of the issues that we're facing?
I don't think we came to a sense of complacency. A lot of people have been doing a lot of hard work for a long time. I think what we're seeing now, though, is a sense of urgency that is really new. I mean, we're talking about wildfires across Colorado that are unprecedented, hurricanes surging into New York City. And our generation of activists and our generation generally is just ready to say no to fossil fuels and move to clean energy as quickly and as rapidly as possible. And I think we're going to stick with it. We have to stick with it. We have to see this through because it's our futures that are on the line.
But how are you going to do that when you've got all this new fossil fuel coming online in the U.S. right now? We've got economic issues here. People are desperate for jobs. They're desperate for cheap energy. And suddenly we've got it right here in this country. And maybe soon, with the State Department's kind of neutral stance on the Keystone Pipeline, I know there will be protests. I'm not writing them off. But a lot of people are thinking Obama may go ahead and approve that pipeline, tar sands coming down. How do you get to clean energy? What kind of protest is it going to take or action is it going to take to get there?
Well, first of all, that pipeline's not getting built as far as we're concerned. Whether we have to kind of move right into that pipeline route and every single mile that thing's going to be built, be there with our bodies to stop it, we're going to do that. We're ready to stop that pipeline. Even if it's permanent, it's not getting built. But I still feel really confident that President Obama is going to listen to this generation. This generation has elected him twice now, and that he's going to reject this thing once and for all. It's his decision, not the State Department's decision, ultimately.
Emily Williams in California, they're talking about this as the Selma, maybe the Selma of your generation, comparing it to the big, of course, civil rights landmark. Do you see the Keystone Pipeline ultimately being built? What do you see your cohort being prepared to do to stop it, Emily?
I don't see it being built. I completely agree with Maura in the way that people will be there to stop it at every single point. This is the key issue of our generation, and so we want to be sure that it doesn't happen. Especially out here, for instance, in Santa Barbara, California, we're not right in the path of the Keystone, and yet we can still offer our support. There's a lot of people I work with out here who are very, very involved in action against the Keystone Pipeline. And some of them are flying out even to stop it. We're ready to do protests. We're ready to have rallies. We're ready to show that this is not something we can stand for. After all, it's our future on the line.
Dorian, I'm reading here of Wynn Stevenson writing at Grist about your generation of protesters. And he says they see the catastrophic trajectory their elders have put the planet on and the failure of governments, corporations, and media to address the crisis in any adequate way. Feel something approaching desperation. You feel forced onto a path of radicalism. Is that about right?
It's definitely something that is becoming increasingly prevalent amongst all of myself and a lot of people that I work with. All of these new reports that are coming out from the World Bank, from the International Energy Agency, do not paint a pretty picture of our future. And what that yields is fear. It's a deep fear of knowing that the world that you grew up in is not the world that you are going to see moving forward, and that is not the world that you can afford to bring your children up in. That instability will be prevalent, that conflict will be prevalent. And growing up, as lucky and as privileged that I have, I haven't yet had to face food instability. I have not felt the hunger of not being able to eat for days or weeks or not knowing when my next meal is going to come from. But with the crop failures...
Do you expect that for you in your lifetime because of climate change?
We saw major crop failures in the Midwest and throughout the country. We've seen food prices skyrocket numerous times in the past decade. We live in a place of extreme wealth in the United States, but I do not believe that makes us safe from these radical changes.
So here we are. People are talking a lot about divestment. Emily, look at that for a minute. Are you working on that in California, getting colleges there to take their money out of fossil fuel companies? Does it look promising?
Yes, that's what we're mostly working on out here. And it does look very promising. We've made a lot of progress so far. Speaking directly for the UCs, so the California Student Sustainability Coalition started up a campaign, I'd say about a year and a half ago, called the End Coal Campaign. And that was sort of a precursor to this divestment movement. And then it was also started up on the East Coast with Swarthmore College. Since then, we at the UCs have been working a lot on trying to figure out how to get our colleges to divest their funds away from the fossil fuel industry. And so what we're doing is we're not targeting each individual campus. We're looking at the UC system as a whole, the UC regions. And so the UCs are now working together, which is really great because that hasn't happened so many times before. But what we're seeing already, we've had three campuses pass resolutions through their student senates that basically say that we, the students, urge the regions to divest their money. And that was at Berkeley, Santa Barbara, and San Diego. We're working with our faculty and our staff. We have some faculty working groups on some of the campuses. And then we're planning to have a really big presence at the Regents meeting coming up in May.
You're getting the attention of some pretty high-placed folks. There's a U.S. Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, a Democrat of Rhode Island. This is on the floor of the Senate in December, talking about the student-led fossil fuel divestment movement.
As Congress sleepwalks, Americans actually are taking action on their own. In coordination with the nonprofit organization 350.org, for example, students at more than 150 colleges and universities across the country are pressing those institutions to sell off the portions of their endowment portfolios that are invested in fossil fuel companies. These students are imploring their schools to weigh the real cost of climate change against the drive for greater financial returns and divest from the polluters.
Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, Maura Kelly, that takes us back to kind of apartheid era movements to divest from South Africa. But these have been pretty successful stocks for a lot of universities' endowments over the years. And some big schools have already said, no, we're not divesting. Is there really the leverage out there to make this happen?
I think there's absolutely the leverage. We already have a lot of victories on the divestment front. We have student colleges, University of Maine, Hampshire, and Sterling have already divested from fossil fuels. Beyond that, this generation is not giving up. We are the generation that has brought you Arab Spring and the revolutions in the Middle East. We are the generation that has brought you the first African-American president in the United States, and we're going to be the generation that brings you clean energy. That is who we are. This is what we have named as one of our top issues for our work as a generation moving forward. And so there's absolutely the leverage. We're the largest generation in U.S. history. There's a lot of people out there, and we all want to see clean energy, and we all want to see this divestment away from fossil fuels.
And what about Ralph Nader's complaint there that he doesn't see the fire in the belly sufficient to the challenge?
Maybe Ralph Nader is getting a little too old and needs to hang out with college kids. I mean, it's out there.
Maybe Therese in Des Moines, Iowa. Therese, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you. Hi, Tom. Discriminating against older people, that's a really good mission for you. You know, we Americans are so tired of hearing about all of this, oh, cleanness, and we're in a crisis and just an emergency. You know, I get, you know, taking care of hardworking coal miners and their families and making sure that there's clean water there. Yes, absolutely. But it's time for us to drill here at home. We cannot afford $4 a gallon gas. I can't afford that. I don't know how you guys afford what you're paying there in California, but we are so for this Keystone Pipeline. It is time to drill here at home, put our Americans to work, use our energy wisely, These cars that they're coming out with, these clean energy cars, are ridiculous. The batteries don't even last 30,000 miles. These companies are figuring out that they can't afford to guarantee these batteries for the life of the car. So then you've got these people with these Hondas, clean energy cars that are no good, and they're going to a landfill. And $5,000 to replace a car battery.
Therese, what do you say to the young people we've got here, though, who say, you know, of course people are worried about their jobs, but if there isn't some change, climate change is going to make everybody miserable, job or no job. What do you say to that, Therese?
They're making we, the American people, miserable by all this rigmarole. These hardworking police officers that have to take their time to remove these people off of these work sites, give me a break. Yes.
Therese, we got it. My time is short before the break, but I appreciate your call. I will take it to them. Dorian, Therese is in Des Moines. She's listening, and you hear that pretty utter lack of sympathy, except with your maybe mountaintop support of coal miners and clean water for them. She just doesn't want to hear it. Rigmarole, she says.
We cannot afford more storms like Sandy. We cannot afford more wildfires. We cannot afford more drought. And we cannot afford the expectation that we can continue this lifestyle that has created the problems we see today. And I understand why that is hard to hear. And I understand that if you don't feel like you will live through what will happen because of climate change, why it's not a reality that you want to face, and it's much more convenient and it's much easier to worry about things like the price of gas. But that is not something, that is not a short-term timeline that I can afford to think about, and that is not a short-term timeline that our country can afford to act based on.
You're 21. Do you expect to see major climate change implications in your lifetime?
We already have seen major climate-related change already, way faster than a lot of the science expected. So what that means in terms of what I will see through my entire lifetime is a huge uncertainty. And it is hard to not immediately go into places of desperation and fears of collapse, because we've seen what happens when resource scarcity plagues a country, plagues a part of the world, and I fear what that will do to this country and the American people.
Dorian Williams, Maura Cowley, Emily Williams in California, please stand by. We're talking about a harder, edgier, more urgent environmental movement with a new generation of climate activists. A little Keystone protest right there in Washington last month. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with environmental activists. No, climate activists, they call themselves. Something beyond the old-fashioned environmentalism that they would hope will be up to the climate challenges of this century. Lots of callers here. Greg in Buffalo, New York. Greg, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm an avid listener. I'm a baby boomer. I'm 62 years old.
Okay.
And I would ask your guests to please not write off my cohort or my generation, despite the phone call that you took a little bit earlier.
Yeah.
I would ask them to use a strategy and a series of tactics of how to begin to engage those of us who still have fire in their belly for climate activism. Maybe we can are in financial positions to offer more financial donations.
Yeah.
Just find ways, a series of tactics of how to engage. I have a series of friends that I know would very much like to be involved.
So. Greg, everybody here has got their hands up. I think by no means do they not want your company in their effort. Dorian, I see you squirming there.
No, I am very reassured, and thank you for that sentiment. And I work all the time with some amazing people from many age groups, many generations. And while climate change puts an extreme burden on ours in particular, everyone who is alive now is seeing the effects, and I see us all being able to come together, working with groups like 350 Massachusetts. That's a local network that has been a hub of a number, drawing from a number of places for people of all ages to get involved. And, you know,
it's, I mean, we brought in the young because you guys have a new sound to the way you're framing this, and maybe indeed faced more imminent changes than another generation, but I don't see any barrier here to participation. Got a lot of people commenting online. Marcus says, on most issues, I see groups like this to be naive kids with too much time on their hands. Well, we are, Marcus writes, we are out of time on climate change, and I don't see any real progress through other approaches, so good for them, Marcus says. North of the Border writes, don't know about you, but I find climate change a very hard topic to discuss among friends and family. It's on everyone's mind, but people can't even bring themselves to talk about it. Maybe climate activists see the writing on the wall and aren't afraid to speak out, sensing that their generation will get stuck holding the bag. Let me go to Phil in Wakefield, Rhode Island. Phil, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you doing?
Pretty well. What do you see?
Well, here in Rhode Island, as you probably know, we've gone through several major storms and just a few months, and I totally attribute it to climate change. And I'm actually on my way home to divest my oil and gas holdings. It's the least I can do. I appreciate the work that these young people are doing.
Hey, Phil, let me ask you, a lot of energy stocks have done pretty well in recent years. You're going to be sad to say goodbye to that, or does it feel like...
No, I'll take my dirty profits and put them into something that hopefully isn't quite as onerous and poisonous.
Hey, there's a man ready to act, Morikawa, ready to change his portfolio for you.
That's great. And I would just say that right now, the wind industry is growing. The solar industry is growing. These are great places to invest. I mean, these are growing industries, which is you don't see every day right now.
But I mean, what's growing faster than those? Fracking. And there's all kinds of interest in these tar sands. You may not want that pipeline, but boy, people are all over that. People are talking about new ways of drilling for oil. I mean, that is growing too. Emily Williams, you must see that. And I wonder if it makes you feel like, you know, the energy companies are just out in front of you, and maybe demand and need is out in front of you.
We really see that out here. It's a fact that a lot of our country's infrastructure is based on the fossil fuel industry, and natural gas and fracking is posing sort of a huge conundrum to us because it is a very new technology in a way, and it's very, a lot of people see it as being something very promising. But what we need to remember is it promising in the long run? And the answer is no. We've already talked about climate change and how this is posing a threat to our future generations, and so we need to nip it in the bud. There are a lot of great industries that are growing, like Mara had mentioned, like the solar industry and the wind energy industry. What we're trying to do with divestment is we're trying to pull away our funds, not to financially cripple the companies, mm-hmm. but to basically cripple their reputation. These companies have such a stranglehold, not only on the political structure, but also on industry in general. They are getting all kinds of subsidies from the government, and it's partly for that reason that renewable energies are not getting the subsidies they need to grow so that they can be completely competitive with the fossil fuel industry.
But let me ask you about this one fairly well-placed individual in this country who, a month and some ago now, was giving a State of the Union address talking about this. Mr. All of the Above on Energy. Here's President Obama.
The natural gas boom has led to cleaner power and greater energy independence. We need to encourage that. And that's why my administration will keep cutting red tape and speeding up new oil and gas permits. That's got to be part of an all-of-the-above plan.
Dorian Williams, there's your president after re-election. That's not part of a re-election campaign there. He's looking at the economy, I guess. He's looking at, he's listening to, well, more than just your groups, obviously, and saying, here we go, all of the above, speed up the permits. Let's drill. Almost drill baby drill.
It's incredibly disappointing and disheartening and, you know, oil and gas are fossil fuels. They contribute to climate change, and natural gas is absolutely a false transition fuel. What is it?
Cleaner than oil, cleaner than coal.
depending on how you look at the methane leaks and how it poisons people's water. Fracking is enormously dangerous both to our climate and to those communities. And if the president is willing to betray my generation and begin speeding up and permitting these projects, we will go to these communities. And what I believe is the front line of this fight is the fossil fuel infrastructure. The communities who are affected by that infrastructure are the frontline communities affected. And that is why I went down to West Virginia. That is why I've taken action against TransCanada to take the fight to them.
What are you suggesting exactly? Maura said that this movement will fight the Keystone Pipeline if necessary, mile by mile. Are you talking about an earth-first sort of approach here? We've seen in the past, you know, things, I don't know, torn apart, set fire, blown up. Is that it? Or is this all strict civil disobedience? What do you have in mind?
We will always remain peaceful. We will always take the moral high ground. What they're doing is dangerous and violent, what they're doing to these communities. The fossil fuel companies. Mm-hmm. They are killing people by poisoning their water and by creating these extreme weather events that have taken so many lives already. And we will fight these infrastructures where they are. We will go mile by mile for all 1,700 of those miles. There are already groups fighting that pipeline. The tar sands blockade has done numerous actions and able to actually make the pipeline rerouted through certain parts of Texas because of their tree sits. And we will go to Texas. We will go to Oklahoma. We will go to West Virginia. We will go wherever we need to be.
Why do you think this president is saying all of the above, speed up the permits? He's been reelected, so it's not about election at this point. What's your analysis, though? Here's a powerful man, not a fool, presumably. And, you know, it's not as though he's done nothing, but many people are disappointed with his first term when it comes to the environment. Why do you think he's taking this position? Is he maybe onto something, that we need this for jobs, or is it something else? How do you interpret it, Doreen?
I don't know. Honestly, I don't know.
Mauro, what do you say?
I mean, right now, oil companies are spending billions of dollars in D.C. and across the country on a misinformation campaign that says oil's clean and oil and gas is safe. And that's not true. It's just like Big Tobacco did when they told us that smoking was safe.
You think the president buys that because he saw it in a TV ad?
We're seeing that industry is infecting the studies around fracking. We're seeing departments across the country that are doing fracking studies that have industry ties.
But I mean, as a serious question, do you think President Obama's sense of reality is shaped by those television ads from the energy industry?
When we were protesting the Keystone XL pipeline, 50,000 people in D.C., President Obama was out golfing with the oil industry. So, yeah, I think he is hearing some pretty faulty stuff from these guys.
Nina in Boston. Thanks for calling, Nina. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
While I agree with your guests on, you know, their desire and to protect the environment for social justice and the stranglehold that corporations have over the government, on the other hand, my question is, given that we have this dependency on oil and energy, how do we avoid foreign entanglements due to this dependency? I mean, we don't want to get into more wars in the Middle East, and it seems on a practical level that getting our oil from Canada does have certain benefits.
Yeah.
Obviously we want to move towards cleaner sources of energy, but that's not going to happen overnight, and I just think that this is not one of these black and white issues, and I'm just wondering what are the practical steps they would say, you know, could be taken.
Nina, let us pick it up. Maura, you hear that. There's somebody who says, okay, the fact is we are dependent at this point. Now, we don't want more wars in the Middle East if we can avoid it, the energy-related wars. So, you know, what do you do? There's an honest question from Nina.
Well, yeah, and I would say this is the number one lie that the fossil fuels companies have been putting out about the Keystone XL pipeline. This oil is not oil that is meant to be used in the U.S. They are building this pipeline down to the Gulf of Mexico. That is where we will export it to other countries. It is a foreign company, TransCanada, that is building a pipeline for export through the United States. That's the fact of the matter. But we, you know, people think we're going to use this oil domestically. We are not going to use this oil domestically. It's going outside of our country.
You can't know that for sure. I mean, they can refine it on the Gulf of Mexico, where a lot of our refineries are, and we could use it here.
The industries have said that this is an export pipeline. And the other thing is that, you know, it is, when we look at the kind of fuel efficiency standards that Obama is putting in place, this will cut the number of fill-ups in half for American families. That's huge. And that means that we actually aren't dependent on this stuff. That is one of the major lies of the fossil fuel companies. They are spending billions of dollars to get Americans to believe this. Meanwhile, the clean energy industries are growing at a rate that is unprecedented. So we have to lean into that, stop subsidizing big oil. And it's really important that right now, President Obama listens to this generation of young people. We see what's on the line, and we really, really need him to pay attention.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let's go to Courtney in Morgantown, West Virginia. Courtney, thanks for calling.
Thanks, Tom. How are you?
Good. What do you think?
Well, I live in West Virginia, and I see every day families who have been affected for generations by coal, then gas, and now fracking. And the misconception remains strong there that this is a necessity for the economy there to be able to function. There are signs all over West Virginia that say end the war on coal, and the misconception is really, it hurts to see that and to see people who are caught in between a rock and a hard place where they see their environment being degraded, their farms being destroyed by fracking, and yet they can't see past that in the economic point of view when there are so many alternatives available.
Yeah, right there in coal country, end the war on coal, say the signs. I mean, Dorian, you were down there. You were in jail down there, I guess. You know, those are jobs. People want their jobs. You can feel that. How do you get through to people who say, fine, ideals, but I need a job?
It's hard. And facing people whose jobs are on the line down in West Virginia is difficult. You know, this is not a simplistic issue in any way, even though there is moral clarity on what needs to be done with climate change. I've met an amazing group of people down there, including Junior Walk, and he had a job in the coal industry because he had nothing else to do, and he came out of it and said, I can't do that anymore. I know what this is doing to my community. I know what this is doing to the world, and I can't do it anymore. I met women in jail whose husbands work for the coal mine, and you just sit down and you talk and be as honest as you can and be like, look, this is where I'm coming from. Mm-hmm. This is what I'm fighting for, and I think there is common ground to be found.
Duke in Glens Falls, New York. Duke, thanks for calling. You're on.
Hey, Tom. I just wanted to make a comment. I came from the 60s. I was a member of SDS as well as a supporter of the Weather Underground. So I know what it's like to be on the front line. I've been arrested. I've been injured. And I've seen friends of mine get killed to step up to the line to fight for their beliefs.
Yep.
And I believe this young girl has you know, the right cause, but I want to know how you're going to step this up, because up until this program, I have not heard one thing about this generation's opinions about the climate change and what's happening with the world.
Our time is short, Duke. Forgive me, but let us pick it up right there. Emily, how are you going to pick it up so that Duke and others like that, you know, who may or may not have ever been in the SDS, hear your message, get the message?
I think the easiest way to get them to hear the message is to actually divest. But in the meantime, we want to just make this a really public issue. We're working a lot on the divestment campaign because the campaign is a really clear message to not just the government, but also to the general public that we don't support this and this is an issue we're working on. And you know, that'll take some time, especially for the University of California to divest its funds. But in the meantime, demonstrations, teach-ins, rallies, getting on more public media such as this show. We really want to get our voice out there. We really want to get people on our side. Young generations, older generations, everyone has a part to play in this.
You're at it. Maura, do you see something new coming here, a way that's going to change public opinion, change policy, or is it just the environmental fight that's gone on forever?
Yeah, I think that this generation is really, really digging in. And one thing I'm really excited about coming up is that we are going to have a massive conference in October and convergence and direct action called Power Shift. And it's going to be in Pittsburgh, PA. And Pittsburgh, PA is the front line for clean energy because we have fracking and clean energy happening there. And our generation's heading to Pittsburgh to make sure that they take the clean energy path and to make sure that our entire country takes the clean energy path.
Dorian, we've got 20 seconds. Are you the outlier? How much of your generation is infused with this kind of determination that you're articulating?
In growing numbers quickly.
You think you're going to get people's attention? You think you're going to change it?
Already have. I went to Westboro. There were 8 of us. And when I went to West Virginia, there was a dozen of us, but we are coming, and we are coming in greater numbers. There were tens of thousands of us in D.C., and we will be back.
Dorian Williams, 21 years old. Emily Williams, 21 years old. Maura Cowley, watching a lot of this all over the country. Our thanks to each of you for being with us today. Thanks a lot. Good luck.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.